You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the March 2, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. This is Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. After mounting a comeback, Eagles face a new threat, written by Maria Kramer for the Science section of the New York Times. Meet Pete, that's P-E-A-T, the unsung hero of carbon capture, written by Sabrina Imbler for the Science section of the New York Times, and, if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. After mounting a comeback, eagles face a new threat. A study of hundreds of bald eagles and golden eagles showed that nearly half of them had chronic lead poisoning. By Maria Kramer, for the Science section of the New York Times. The bald eagle, whose resurgence is considered one of the great conservation success stories of the 21st century, is facing a serious threat, lead poisoning. Researchers who tested the feathers, bones, livers, and blood of 1,200 bald eagles and golden eagles, another bird of prey in the Northern Hemisphere, found that nearly half of them had been exposed repeatedly to lead, which can lead to death and slow population growth. Scientists believe that the primary source of the lead is spent ammunition from hunters who shoot animals that eagles then scavenge, usually during the winter, according to the study, which was published on Thursday in the journal Science. Nearly a third of the birds tested also showed signs of acute poisoning or short-term exposure to lead, according to the study, which was led by scientists from the United States Geological Survey, the Conservation Science Global, Inc., and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The effects of lead poisoning are devastating, said Vincent A. Slabe, the lead author of the study and a research wildlife biologist for Conservation Science Global in Montana. Lead poisoning can prevent an eagle from digesting food properly, eventually leading to starvation, he said. It can cause loss of locomotion so severe that an eagle will lose the ability not only to fly, but also to move at all, he said. Lead can affect every single system of an eagle's body, their respiratory system, their digestive system, their reproductive system, Dr. Slabe said. The study, which examined bald eagles and golden eagles from 38 states, is the first to look at the effects of lead poisoning on the bird population on such a large scale, said Todd E. Kantzner, a research wildlife biologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. The research also showed that poisoning slowed down population growth rates by about 4% for bald eagles and 1% for golden eagles, which number about 35,000. The population of bald eagles is now above 300,000, according to researchers. These percentages seem small, but over time thousands and thousands of individual birds are being removed from the population because of lead poisoning, Dr. Kantzner said. Bald eagles decades ago had been killed off largely by the widespread use of the synthetic insecticide DDT. A ban on DDT in 1972 and conservation efforts helped the population to rebound, with the bald eagle being removed from Endangered Species Act protection in 2007. Dr. Slabe said he hoped the report's findings would help to educate hunters and encourage more of them to switch to lead-free ammunition. This is 100% human-caused and totally preventable, said Laura Hale, president of the Badger Run Wildlife Rehab in Klamath Falls, Oregon, whose organization has taken in bald eagles, golden eagles, and different species of hawks that were poisoned by lead. In 2018, the group tried to save an eagle that a hunter had found in the woods and was unable to fly and found gasping for air. When Ms. Hale told the hunter that the eagle was most likely become sick from feeding on contaminated gut piles, the remains left behind after a hunter strips the animal's carcass of its meat, she said he was stricken. "He was horrified," Ms. Hale recalled. "He wanted to stop hunting." Ms. Hale said she told him that he didn't have to stop hunting. He needed only to stop using lead ammunition. Many hunters concerned about effects not only on wildlife, but also on game meat consumed by humans, have been moving away from lead ammunition and have begun using copper bullets. Sporting Lead Free, a hunters and anglers group based in Wyoming that seeks to raise awareness about the adverse effects of lead ammunition, posted a short film with testimonials from hunters who stopped using it. "Hunters are conservationists," said Brian Bedrosian, a co-founder of Sporting Lead Free and a raptor biologist. "This doesn't need to be a polarizing issue." Some hunters hesitate to switch ammunition because of tradition, a mistaken belief that copper bullets are less effective, or because they have a backlog of lead bullets, he said.
"Then there are still folks who just don't know,"
said Mr. Bedrosian, who says he uses lead bullets at the range where he knows the ammunition will not come into contact with wildlife. Hannah Leonard, the group's outreach coordinator, said she hunted with lead bullets until 4 years ago, when she came upon an emaciated golden eagle hobbling on the ground while she was hunting in Anaconda, Montana. "Her talons were really clenched, and her wings were drooped. You could tell she was in danger," Ms. Leonard said. The eagle later died, and Ms. Leonard said the animal rescue group she called to try to save the bird told her the cause of death was lead poisoning.
"It was a no-brainer for me to switch types of ammunition," she said.
In January 2017, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a policy to phase out the use of lead ammunition and fishing tackle used on national wildlife refuges, one of the last acts by the Obama administration. The Trump administration reversed the decision less than 2 months later. On Friday, the service declined to say whether that policy would be reinstated as a result of the new study. There has been a nationwide ban on the use of lead shot for hunting waterfowl since 1991, according to the service. California prohibits the use of lead ammunition statewide, including on federal land, largely to prevent adverse impacts of lead on the California condor, which is endangered. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service uses the best available scientific data to conserve wildlife populations and evaluate compatible uses on the lands that we manage, as well as under applicable local, state, and federal laws. Vanessa Kaufman, a spokesman for the agency, said on Friday. Dr. Slabe said that hunters, once they were educated, would voluntarily stop using lead ammunition.
"Hunters are very receptive to this issue," he said. "Hunters are the solution to this problem."
Meet Pete. That's P-E-A-T, the unsung hero of carbon capture. Written by Sabrina Imbler. This article was written as an illustrated article for readers of all ages as an introduction to the history and unique qualities of peat and peatlands. Over thousands of years, A mossy landscape lived and died, but it did not decay. Trapped in ground so wet that it could not decompose, the dead moss instead piled up, each layer pressing those beneath into a thick, muddy mass called peat. For centuries, humans have wandered onto these soggy stretches of moss and asked the same question. What is a peatland good for? You can't build a house on it, it's too soft. Or grow crops there, it's too soggy. And all that stagnant water conjures a timeless fear of mosquitoes and then malaria. However, scientists eventually learned that thick brown peat holds a secret. Vast stores of carbon sealed underground and out of the atmosphere, making the muck one of the world's best carbon sinks. Although peatlands make up just 3% of land on Earth, they store twice as much carbon as all the world's forests combined. Peatlands can take on many forms, from wetlands' greatest hits, bogs and fens, to deeper cuts, pocosins, palsa, blanket bogs, and tropical peat swamp forests. The secret of many peatlands is sphagnum mosses, starry green sprouts that can hold up to 26 times their weight in water. On drier ground, dead plants rot and send their carbon back into the soil or atmosphere. But a peatland is so soggy that even the deadest shrub can't fully decompose, meaning its carbon stays put. This peculiar limbo isn't just for plants. A peatland also prevents other things from decay, trapping an archive of thousands of years of life and death underground with all that carbon. Anything that happens to fall into a peat bog might be preserved, if a little worse for wear. For example, 2,000-year-old lumps of butter, a 4,700-year-old wheel, a 10,500-year-old canoe. Bogs turn 1,000-year-old human bodies into mummies so lifelike they've been mistaken for modern murder victims. In a way, a peatland is less a land than a memory of what has existed on it, where life is not lost, but preserved in muddy murk. Before it was celebrated as the world's best carbon sink, peat was a popular energy source. Peat burned hotter than wood and was far less dangerous to mine than coal. All you need is a sharp hoe and a couple of arms. The Dutch, with few forests left to burn, harvested enough peat in the 17th century to help usher in a golden age of wealth, science, and art. Elsewhere, humans saw peatlands as ugly mud that stood in the way of valuable crops. Vast tracts of Indonesia's tropical peatlands were drained and razed into palm plantations. In Canada, home to a quarter of the world's northern peatlands, expanses of peat have been drained to build mines and roads and flooded for hydroelectric dams. Today, humans have already drained about 15% of the world's peatlands. As we began to understand the threat of climate change, forests emerged as a natural solution, spawning plans to plant a million, a billion, a trillion trees. But we paid little attention to peatlands, the unsung heroes of carbon capture. A disturbed peatland, though, can become a villain, morphing from a carbon sink into a carbon spewer. Drained peatlands emit about a dizzying 2 billion tons of accumulated carbon every year. This number is only expected to rise as the world warms and peatlands dry out, priming the land to catch fire and burn. In other words, the world's peatlands are becoming a vicious climate feedback loop. Peat drying and burning and drying and burning. The most damaged peatlands may never return to their golden days as carbon sinks, but they are surprisingly resilient and can be revived to a point where they're on the way to storing carbon again. To heal a peatland, you need to re-wet it, blocking any drains or canals to recreate the original waterlogged conditions that thwart plants from total decay. The soggier, the boggier. In the meantime, new peatlands continue to be discovered, including a Peruvian swamp forest teeming with fruit, a tropical peat swamp larger than England in the Congo Basin, and forest fens in the Rocky Mountains that harbor plant species that have stuck around since the Ice Age. A protected peatland can preserve all the riches lurking in its thick brown depths, bones, butter, and world-changing stores of carbon. There is still time to put peatlands, long manipulated, forever overlooked, on their rightful pedestal as nature's champion against climate change. Traumatized apes are being nursed back to health in Congo's war-torn east. From the Nature and Environment section of Euronews Online, written by Ben Anthony Horton. As the Central African market for bushmeat expands, great ape poaching is now reaching crisis point with over 3,000 apes illegally killed or stolen from the wild each year. Vast networks of logging roads, modern weapons, and cheap transportation are behind the rise, with poachers claiming as much as 6 million tons of bushmeat annually from the Congo Basin alone. But away from the bloodshed, a refuge hidden among the trees of the Kayuzi Biega National Park is offering hope for Congo's endangered primates. "These orphan chimps are coming to us because of insecurity and war," says Sylvester Libaku, manager of the Luwero Ape Rehabilitation Center, or CRPL. "We just want to let the animals live peacefully in their natural habitat." With an assortment of at-risk apes from 16 different species, the sanctuary has nursed wounded animals back to health for over 2 decades. Among its wards are chimpanzees, gorillas, and bonobos, all saved from poachers in a region where illegal activity goes largely unchallenged. "The gorillas only need security," says Lambert Sirimwami, head of the Kahuzi Biega Park Guides. "If they have that, they will grow up very easily and very quickly." For the carers who tend to Luwero's endangered apes, bloodshed is a part of everyday life. Many of their charges need constant attention after arriving at the facility, with complex injuries resulting from their entanglements with bushmeat hunters. "First, we try to put in place all the means to see how to save the animal's life," says Ernest Kalalize, veterinary assistant at the center. "In the case of injuries or other serious cases, we see how to stop the bleeding, then anesthetize the animal before suturing it and returning it to its enclosure. Once there, the animals are cared for by the sanctuary's 55 members of staff, many of whom work around the clock to tend to the primate's every need. Each of the 110 chimpanzees, at the sanctuary eats as much as 6 kilos of fruit, cereals, and vegetables every day. The infants are bottle-fed by their carers. "We arrive here at 6:30 a.m., says Libaku. "First, we give them meatballs and bananas, and if they are sick animals, that's when we take the opportunity to give them medicine, too." Many months of care are needed to stabilize an animal at the facility. Bordering the Cahuzi Biega National Park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Luwero Center was founded in 2002 by the Congolese Institute for the Conservation of Nature. Some 250 eastern lowland gorillas live in the neighboring rainforest, the last of their kind in the wild. Much like their relatives in the sanctuary, these apes are at the mercy of poachers looking to hunt and kill them, often to provide food for their families. For Kalalize, this could all change if the Congolese government provided more financial assistance to the sanctuary. There is still not 100% government involvement in the management of the Luwero Primate Rehabilitation Center, says the veterinary assistant. It's run through the efforts of people who, out of their own goodwill, are trying to see how to protect the animals that are very much under threat. And one more item from Euronews Online. Heat waves kill more people than flooding. Will naming them help save lives? By Nicola Daunton. The U.S. state of California is considering naming heat waves after its record-breaking drought enters its third year. The western state experienced its hottest summer on record in 2021 and is now seeing the driest start to a year in recorded history. January and February are supposed to be the wettest months. While above-average rainfall at the beginning of January provided some initial hope, it had dropped considerably by the middle of the month. Due to severe drought conditions, 2021 was an historic year for wildfires, too. Though wildfires in California are a common occurrence, their prevalence and intensity in 2021 was unprecedented. Over 2.5 million acres were burnt by October, making it the second worst year on record. While people have been naming storms, tornadoes, and hurricanes for centuries, the National Hurricane Center only began officially naming tropical cyclones back in the 1950s. The practice is particularly useful when two storms are taking place at the same time and is thought to raise awareness and help prepare for incoming weather systems. However, scientific data is lacking on whether naming storms helps save lives. The National Weather Service is not aware of any research or evidence that suggests naming heat waves would raise awareness about heat-related risks, according to Kimberly McMahon, an NWS Public Weather Service's program manager, but she concedes the early warnings can help people to prepare for extreme weather. Even knowing the potential for a heat wave or abnormally hot summer can allow preparations to occur in advance. Thank you for joining us for the March 2, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. This is Karen Wheeler.